This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
The goal of this podcast since day one is to provide the best information on the Vancouver real estate market at no cost to you, the listeners. To that end, we'd like to thank the following sponsors.
This podcast is sponsored by Marcon, a local family-owned and managed real estate development and construction company that's been around for nearly four decades. Marcon is not only committed to high-quality construction, but it also is making a positive impact in the communities in which it builds, all across the Lower Mainland.
We want to highlight two incredible Marcon projects. Elmwood, a 38-story tower located at Burquitlam's most important intersection, Como Lake Avenue and Clark Road. This landmark tower will feature 335 condominiums, over 37,000 square feet of office and retail space, and almost 20,000 square feet of amenity space. Elmwood has been incredibly popular with 80% sold currently, but they still have a great selection of junior one-bedroom all the way to three-bedroom homes remaining. Check out marcon.ca/elmwood for more.
And Matt, we are also excited about Soane House, Marcon's newest community in West Coquitlam, with 165 homes ranging from junior one beds to three beds. Soane House offers the perfect West Coast aesthetic with a more nuanced Nordic-inspired design. Register today at marcon.ca/soanehouse. That's S-O-E-N-H-A-U-S. Or you can learn more at marcon.ca or follow them at Instagram at Marcon Homes.
Marcon, building for life.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, today I'm super excited because we have Michael Mortensen. Michael is the director of Livable City Planning Limited. He's an urban planner, an adjunct professor at UBC Sauder School of Business. All around, hilarious and insightful guy. Really, really enjoyed this conversation.
Great turns of phrases. There's a few things about Michael, right? One, very fun to listen to.
Yeah.
Very
you
bright.
You were just scribbling down his
I
phrases.
I was jotting down his phrases. There's one about Flin Flon that really stuck with me.
Yeah. You've just adopted his... Yeah,
I know. I talk like him now.
Yeah, exactly. This is like talented Mr. Ripley. How's the peeping, Tommy? How's the peeping? It's a good show, though.
It's a great show. And yeah, one of the reasons we asked Michael on, apart from kind of the wide-reaching conversation we had, is recently, well, Michael Ferreira was the one who pointed it out. Michael,
right. Good friend of the show.
Good friend of the show. Fan favorite, absolutely. He's coming back on soon from Urban Analytics.
Right.
But he said, you got to get Michael on to speak to the Patrick Condon episode we had.
Sure.
And these guys went at it in the Taiyi recently.
Oh, yeah. Some real academic sparring. Couple gloves off jabs to the face.
There might even be a couple knockout blows in this episode today.
It's always that's my favorite thing about the academic side of this show is we've had also we had a match between Tom Davidoff and Andrei Pavlov,
both good friends of the show.
Yeah,
but man,
we had actually,
they don't agree on much.
Do you remember that we did that in Tom's kitchen,
and Andrei wouldn't even say it was his. He wouldn't even admit it was a kitchen.
Yeah,
that's how little these guys agree,
right? But they both agree that the donuts we brought were delicious. here's the thing: I would love to get Patrick Condon and Michael Mortensen in the same room to debate this issue on supply and on, of course, the MERP.
Yeah, this is the apartment program that the city of Vancouver has. Basically, how to create affordable housing in the city, who should be building it,
right.
What the incentives should be. It's all the devil's in the details, but this conversation, I don't want to undersell it. This is an exciting conversation.
No, exactly. Because we talk about, he's so interesting from so many different perspectives because he's a planner, but he also comments on what's happening in the market. He's working with Urban Analytics in a lot of ways.
And developers.
And developers.
What does he call himself?
A practical academic,
I think. Right. He's marrying two terms.
There's no critique of the ivory tower for this guy. He's on the ground.
That's right.
But really, we cover a lot of things, and we talk about the market, where the market's going, affordability, why are we so expensive, what's going to happen over the next few years. We do some predictions. This is just an incredible episode all around.
I've been thinking about a lot of this since we talked to him, a week and a half ago for sure. So yes. Stay tuned for that. Michael is fantastic. What else do we got before we cut to the interview? Well, a few things.
Yeah.
One is the stats came out. More of the same.
Right.
More of the same.
This feels like the busiest out of the gates start to a market, at least in my career, that I've ever been involved in. You know, it feels just so busy right now. And every agent we're talking to is just kind of running off
their
feet.
It is crazy. Like, there's a few interesting things I've been thinking about here. Like, one is a lot of old clients. It's funny how many people ask this. Like, how is business different than it was, you know, pre-COVID? Mm-hmm. Not in terms of the market, but actually just how you go about showing houses. And in a lot of ways, it's business as usual. But as January ramped up to feel like kind of fever pitch April, it actually dawned on me that it's different, right? You used to have an open house with, you know, 25, 30 people through. Well, you can't do that anymore.
Sure.
So there's two ways it's different. One is it's almost, for a busy listing, it's almost hard to get people through.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have enough spaces, time slots allotted to get everybody who wants to get through. But two, if you're working as a buyer's agent, like my Sunday, this past Sunday, you know, usually you say, okay, well, you know, people are going through opens and we're reconnecting on certain things, but you're not. Now you basically have to line up appointment after appointment after appointment. You know, I started before 10 o'clock and right up to 6, just from showing to showing to showing to showing to showing multiple clients. It was crazy. And I was, you know, the agent was late for the first appointment, screwed up the whole day for me. I was late for every appointment.
The one thing about going out on tour, that's the thing that you, if you screw up the
one
first
of the most
one,
stressful things
it's
about
a dominoes effect.
I hate to say it, but it is the worst. When you're 15 minutes behind for an entire day,
there's some agents that's just how they roll.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I'm 15 minutes behind. They don't even call or text.
But the thing is like, you can plan. It doesn't matter how long you've been in the business or how well you plan, because there's so many moving parts. There's other people that show up late. There's clients who take longer than you think, you know, staring at a storage locker. There's all sorts of things that can mess something up.
Right.
And one, it's a domino effect.
Yeah.
But anyway, one more thing, Adam, about the kind of busyness of this start of February is, you know, we met with a couple of good friends of the program, Michael Yu last night.
Owner of Oakland Realty.
And Corey Wright from William Wright this
morning.
Best
dressed guy in the business, owner of William Wright Commercial.
By far the best dressed guy in the business. And like, part of the conversation that happened there was, it's interesting that 2021 is shaping up to, it feels like 2016, 2017, where, but there's no bogeyman. Right?
Yeah.
Who's to blame now? Is it shadow flipping? Is it foreign buyers? Like, all of those things are gone, right?
Yeah.
We're much more regulated.
Yeah.
The debate between, is it supply? Is it, you know, demand from outside? All these things. I feel like the verdict's in.
Right.
And we're running like we never have before.
It's busy.
There's very few. I guess this is all to say, and we've heard it on this program before, there are very few bullets left in the government gun here to shoot at this market, and like, where do we go from here?
Is the verdict in? Is it bogeyman or boogeyman?
Because I think it's bogey.
Okay,
maybe it's boogeyman.
Is it boogeyman? Because I mean, the boogeyman lives in your closet. The bogeyman is that I don't know. What else we got for today?
What else do we have? Oakland Realty is our sponsor. This is our brokerage, the best brokerage in town,
right?
Bar none. The culture is incredible. If you're a new agent, an aspiring agent, somebody who's just looking to make a change, looking to get in into a work environment that's very exciting.
Which also happens to be one of the fastest growing companies in Canada right now.
Head over to oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. I think part of on the agenda yesterday with Michael was to update that
We talked right through it.
It's too much to catch up on. Still VRP 2020.
Yes.
Oakland.com/join VRP 2020. Meet with Michael, Morgan, and the gang. You will not be disappointed. Also, Adam, we have The Sellers Club.
Yeah, Matt. And if you are not part of a Sellers Club, what are you doing? There's no better club to be part of. It's COVID safe.
This is like being at a party in the penthouse at Telus Gardens on Saturday night.
God, eh?
That was nuts.
What? Why? Why? What are you doing? What? But they were interviewing guys that owned it. Like, how did they even get them all up?
Also,
like how did you get to the penthouse?
Also, why? It sounds like the guy owns the penthouse at Telus Gardens, like a 3-floor penthouse.
Does he?
But it also sounded like it was fully, the whole plan was to make money as a nightclub. Like it seems
was it?
Like
he was charging.
He was charging. I think there was door fees. I think there was bottle service. But like it was a nightclub.
Yeah.
He was looking to make money. And it seems like if you own the penthouse at Telus Garden, you might want to not find a loophole in, or not even. It wasn't even a loophole. It was just breaking the rules.
I was actually out 2 days ago with a client of mine who she's been vaccinated. And it was kind of great. It's like a superpower. It's like, what are you doing here? Why are you not in a nightclub at Telus Gardens or in the Bahamas or something? But really, she's vaccinated. And I guess she's in the healthcare world. But the reality, though, is just ripped my mask off immediately. Drove
she
in
must
the same car.
Actually, it must be incredible for her. Right?
Yeah, and
she's
I guess
walking through the superpower. That's exactly
it is a
it.
Superpower. It is. I even told as I was leaving the house. I told Sabrina, my wife, and she was like, "Really? Like it's weird right now." And she was super excited about it. I showed up without a mask. She got in with a mask on. And then she was like, looked at me like, what are you doing? And I was so excited to be mask free. But apparently they
you
don't
shook hands. The
they
entire
don't
time.
Know if she can transfer COVID. Like she could still potentially be a conduit. So I had to put my mask back on, but it was in the trunk. So we had to drive awkwardly with me holding my breath.
But anyway, this is all to say the Sellers Club.
Yes.
You should definitely be a part of the Sellers Club. What exactly is the Sellers Club?
Yeah, the Sellers Club, Matt. We are sending out the best resources for how to sell your home for top dollar in the shortest amount of time. You can just send us an email or you can be on the LiveWire list, which is our newsletter, and just respond. We have a button on the mailer that goes out once a week. And Matt, we've been kind of at this for now 11 minutes.
This is probably far too long.
Cut to our interview.
We should cut to our interview. Last but not least, we do have a spring incentive.
Yes.
This is for listeners of this show who are looking to list their property this spring with Scalina Real Estate. Big incentive for you and your friends and family. This incentive is transferable. So if you know people that you think, hey, these guys should use some pros, get top dollar, sell their place, and get an incentive. We're very open to those referrals as well. Everybody wins, especially your friends and family and yourself. Spring incentive over at Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. But maybe, Adam, we should cut to our talk with Michael Mortensen.
This one will not disappoint. One of my favorite chats we've had in a very long time. Michael Mortensen.
Enjoy.
Okay, so we're here with Michael Mortensen. He's an urban planner, adjunct professor at UBC Sauder School of Business, and director of Livable City Planning Limited. How are you doing, Michael?
Pretty good, Matt. Hi, Adam. How are you doing?
Great, great. Thanks for taking the time today, Michael.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Can you maybe start, Michael, by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm an urban planner who does development consulting. And as you mentioned, I teach at UBC and SFU in the city program. And I have multiple vantage points on the industry. I work both in the private sector. I consult for public sector organizations like BC Housing. In my past, I worked for CMHC, looking after half of the province's affordable housing stock, the operating agreements that govern how co-ops and nonprofits work. So I've got multiple viewpoints on the development industry in Vancouver and the region. So I work at all scales. So I'm a director of an organization called Small Housing BC that advocates for sensitive types of infill. Asking the question, how do we make better use of our existing land? And I also work at the large scale, developing master plan projects that include towers, multi and mixed use development.
Fantastic. Just kind of out of left field, and I haven't been in a university for a long time, but we have talked to a lot of people from the Sauder School, which I don't think this necessarily applies, but being in both the private sector and in the kind of academic world, do you find there's a big disconnect there? How do you see those two worlds? Like, are they actually talking to each other?
Sometimes. And definitely, Sauder reaching out to people working in the industry who have their hands on actual, live development projects is an example of where academia meets the sort of practical reality of the world. I like to call it pracademics, people who have both the ability to teach, but are also very directly involved in some form of work that they're teaching. So, I kind of consider myself a pracademic.
Nice.
But sometimes you do get academics who don't have a lot of direct current knowledge or experience. So there's a challenge sometimes there.
Right. A lot of theorizing, but not that real world kind of practicality. How to get things built? How to actually get things done?
Sometimes.
So, Michael, maybe we'll start we're obviously in the midst of a pandemic here, and we're curious because the city of Vancouver has had some real pain points during COVID, I think. And how has COVID changed the trajectory of the city, and what do you think the long-term impact will be, if any?
I don't think it's budged the trajectory of the city of Vancouver, frankly. If anything, it reinforces Vancouver's place in the world as a safe place to live, with a great healthcare system, civil society, the rule of law, great education, a great physical environment. I think we've done quite well. And I know people are hurting economically, but I think generally the city has proved itself to be resilient. Our cities have proved themselves to be resilient as well, too. Even high density parts of our city, like the downtown core, we have not seen massive full-blown pandemic exposures in high-rise buildings, for example, where people feared that, this is the end of the high-rise or this is the end of the office. I think those things are still going to be powerful forces moving forward.
So it sounds like in your mind, this all the talk about people moving to the suburbs, people moving to smaller communities, Kennedy Stewart worrying about the city going bankrupt. I think that was in the near term, but all these things were a little overblown.
I think there are near-term challenges in terms, including the economic challenges of tax revenue, for example, and people paying rent. Those are all really serious near-term issues. But long-term, I think people will there will be a tendency to try and work from further, live in cheaper places where you can get more space. But in general, I think the world will still be moving to Vancouver in big numbers, just on the basis of our quality of life and the quality of our cities. Not just Vancouver, but I'm thinking about the entire region. I do think that the exodus to the suburbs, if people do make that choice, they'll learn fairly quickly if it works for them or not. Sometimes I think of the far-flung suburban lifestyle as a prison sentence served in small increments, where people get trapped on the freeway every day, an hour in, an hour out. That adds up. It adds up to actually a long sentence, and you don't get out until you stop working. So that's kind of my take on it.
I had a conversation with a friend of mine the other day. I'm just wondering if the one of the big fallouts of this will be that there's a bunch of people living in the suburbs going, "What have I done?" Right?
there'll be a boomerang effect. I think as some people say, "Oh, this isn't for me." It can work for some people, and it will, given telecommuting and being able to work from home. But you know what? The need for interaction, and people are hungry. I mean, I was just talking to one of the architects working on a big project I'm doing, and he's just dying for social interaction and the collegiality of face-to-face work, where you can just both work over a table with some plans and actually have real-time conversation with all the nuances of real interaction and conversation. I don't think telework is ever going to replace that.
Right. So we've been doing this for a number of years, and you know, I would say from 2016 through to March of 2020, you know, it was in some respects kind of this ongoing conversation about this move towards urban centers and global cities, and you know, talent begets talent, and all these kind of conversations that COVID seems to have stopped in its tracks a little bit. It sounds like you're kind of confident in Vancouver's place in the world and the region. I'm just wondering, and I'm thinking kind of a story I read in the New York Times maybe a week ago about, you know, all these Silicon Valley people leaving San Francisco and going to Florida and Texas and all over the place, and they're realizing, oh, it's so much cheaper, what a great move this has been. Can you just talk a little bit more, I guess, less about Vancouver and the region and more about just cities in general and how they figure into the landscape moving forward?
Well, I think of, you know, Lewis Mumford, The City in History, really great book for, you know, people starting urban studies, or Jane Jacobs, where they both talk about work and new work, new ideas, and cities as the epicenters for new ideas. Richard Florida talks about this too, cities as cultural centers of production. You know, nothing is going to change that. I think we need that sort of propinquity gathering intensity in order to exchange new ideas, create new ideas, new ways of living, new ways of working. That's not going to change. So I think, you know, some people may move and find other places. And yeah, you know, there are a lot of really cheap places. David Baxter, a demographer who, you know, he did a lot of work in Vancouver, he once said, you know, that house in Flin Flon, Manitoba, is going to be the most expensive house you ever buy in your life. Because your future earnings are going to plummet, generally speaking.
Right.
You know, so I think cities will always have that magnet appeal. They always have, from, you know, Babylon, Mesopotamia, Ur, to the present day. Cities are centers of innovation and you know, new ideas.
As two guys who grew up playing hockey in Flin Flon, Manitoba. that really hits home.
Getting beat up on the rink in Flin Flon.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, 2 minutes in the penalty box.
Yeah.
And just as an aside here, we're pretty early on in this talk, and I feel like there's already two lines I'm going to use. The Flin Flon line and that great line about the prison. This is fantastic.
Yeah. Prison sentence served in small increments.
I'll cite you though, for sure.
Excellent.
So Michael, one of the things that kind of keeps coming up on this show is the idea of like the last pandemic leading to the Roaring Twenties, and the feeling right now, like you've kind of talked how you know, colleagues and it just seems like that's the buzz out there, that everybody wants to get back to social interaction. Do you see this as kind of a you know, with the vaccination on its way? And this desire for people to kind of break out of lockdown, do you see this as the beginning of potentially the Roaring 2020s in Canada?
Roaring 2020. I think they're more moderating influences, you know, at least within the real estate industry. You know, we have four levels of government all trying to impact housing demand, you know, housing supply, with various levels of success. I think we have fiscal policy on the federal level in terms of mortgage spending and qualification that's still in place. You know, the cost of land is high, the cost of construction is high, the cost of government fees has skyrocketed over the last few decades as well. So there's pent up demand. I think you'll see it in the housing market as people, you know, who have been waiting in the sidelines to buy something. Move forward. Interest rates are super low. You know, I think you can get a mortgage now for 1.6%,
right.
which is ridiculous. I mean, really, 1.6%. That's crazy. So there will be, I think, and we've seen, I think there has been, you know, a surge in activity in real estate. But yeah, I think people are going to get back to what they love doing, you know, and that's in cities and outside of cities, and, you know, doing things with friends, gathering, going out to, you know, restaurants, clubs, sporting events, music. I mean, we're all hungry for that, absolutely. And I think our downtowns across the region are all going to light up again once we all get vaccinated. Can't wait. Can't be soon enough.
No kidding. So it sounds like anyone listening who's waiting for a big correction in the near term here, you're not expecting at least that. Can we talk a little bit about just your take on Vancouver generally? Like, why is Vancouver so expensive, and how did we get here?
I think it's always been expensive. It's a peninsula. The city and region sit on a peninsula of land, bordered by the mountains, the ocean, the U.S. border. I think, if you go outside of Montreal and draw a circle with a 50-kilometer radius, you get about 8,000 square kilometers of land. You go to Toronto, do the same thing because of Lake Ontario, you get 4,000 square kilometers of land. But come to Vancouver and do that same 50-kilometer radius, you have 1,800. You're a quarter of what Montreal has in terms of terra firma. So land is precious, and it gets, the price of it gets bid up in really good locations, right? Construction costs, they're not going down. The cost of material, labor, energy is all increasing. And as I said before, federal taxes, GST on rental, provincial taxes, property transfer tax, jacked up to 5% for large assemblies. Regional taxes, DCCs have doubled. City DCCs and CACs, they're now comprised like 15 to 20% of the cost of housing. So I think those are all the forces making housing, dear. And it's always been relatively expensive in this region, from the beginning of the city.
And it sounds like there's kind of two components there. There's the natural components, I guess we can term it, but then there's policy involved in that. Like, has there been missteps along the way in terms of policy, zoning, CACs, that type of thing? Like, can you speak a little bit more onto that topic?
Sure. I think if you look at the land, we should go back to, when Vancouver actually solidified land use plans with Euclidean zoning under Bartholomew, the 1920s, late 20s, 27, 28, with the Bartholomew plan. I'm speaking just of Vancouver here, but, the rest of the region sort of followed suit. I think, we've done well in retrofitting the urban core, after the decline of industry. Walter Hardwick, who I studied with, I was Walter's last graduate student at UBC. I did a thesis called Retrofitting Suburbs. And the basic question is, what do we do with our post-war suburbs, auto-dependent, low-density, sprawling, generally? The answer I found in working with Walter was, why don't we look at our inner city and our streetcar neighborhoods that evolved before the Bartholomew Plan, where change could be organic and incremental? So we went through the Great Depression, the trials of the First World War, the Great Depression after, and people evolved and changed their housing, and neighborhoods changed and evolved, generally with less planning restrictions than we have today. But the land use plan we have today reflects very much the 1927 Bartholomew plan. So we have right now, for example, almost 60% of our city locked into RS1 single detached housing use that is affordable to less than 3% of our families based on income. So we have this weird situation. We have a form of economic apartheid, where we have land use zoning, it says, no, you can only build a single family home, or maybe a single family home with a secondary suite, maybe a duplex, but that still doesn't budge the needle on affordability. I think what the great learning I've seen in our city, how people responded to the increase in cost of housing, is to make better use of land, to increase the intensity of our use of land while making contributions towards commensurate increases in amenity. So we look at our streetcar suburbs or the downtown, and we've seen enormous, increases in density and the use of land, but also, significant investments in amenity, daycares, parks, schools, cultural facilities, recreational facilities. So we have this kind of balance. So downtown's a fabulous success story. Maybe too successful, because people realize, whoa, everybody wants this, and the price of downtown housing has now gone up quite significantly. But I tell you what, when I was a student, a grad student at UBC, I bought my first apartment downtown for $129,000 in the downtown south, which was part of that period in the 90s and early 2000s when the downtown core doubled in population. And there was this flood of new housing on the market. And I picked up, $129,000 loft apartment. I mean, it was 580 square feet. So not the biggest place, but tell you what, I bought it. I was a student. I almost didn't have a full-time job yet. And with a $5,000 RSP. So, you know, that was a success story in terms of living first, putting families downtown, creating this lovely living environment that was walking distance to, you know, thousands of jobs. You know, I think that was a success. The streetcar suburbs of Vancouver are still the most desirable places to live in this city. Strathcona, Kitts, Mount Pleasant, leafy streets. But you look behind the leafy front yards and the trees, and there's multifamily housing. And I think that's the way forward, is to open up our city to more intense forms of multifamily living while preserving the kind of the bits that people really appreciated about our city, and most of it's landscaping and trees, frankly. Nice streets.
And the way to get there, and I'm wondering if I'm getting this right, but it sounds like the problems have been kind of central planning, as I understand it, where what your thesis at least was looking into was kind of a more organic, market-oriented kind of solution. Is that what, am I understanding that right?
I think so. I think you know, we saw like organic change in the downtown and the streetcar suburbs in the absence of really firm zoning control. And then it was codified, you know, later on. So we saw, you know, RM zones, multi-family apartment zones in Kitts. The city experimented with coach house infill. You saw a lot of really good experiments. And then, of course, downtown, you know, sort of the Vancouverism model of the Point Tower and the row house on the bottom. We have all these sort of living models of what we could do in other parts of the city. And we could easily codify those. So, you know, through Small Housing BC, on which I serve as a director, we're looking at and advocating the city to open up RS1 zoning to allow gentle forms of infill and, you know, multifamily. A duplex, you know, if the starting price for a lot is $2 million, just carving it into a duplex isn't going to move the needle on affordability, or let's call it accessibility. So currently in the RS zones, you know, 3% of families can afford to buy an RS1 house based on income. You know, the people buying are coming into this market with a lot of assets and a lot of equity and buying, you know, $2 million, $3 million plus homes. I think we need to see are forms of, you know, fourplexes or six-packs, as my friend at the city, Pat St. Michelle, she designed RN10, I think, zoning for six packs. So, you know, creating a six unit type of infill. Now that'll move the needle on affordability, and I think create housing that may be affordable to a quarter of households rather than just 3%. So I guess, you know, when we're thinking about that, we can't say, oh, it's affordable housing, because frankly, you need a fair amount of income to afford it. But it's at least way more accessible and attainable to that bandwidth of income earners. And then we have to look at, you know, the other submarkets in our city, too. I think that's something that we really need to focus on a little more, both in the ownership sector and the rental sector, is the different submarkets that we have in our market.
Yeah, maybe in thinking about the rental sector, the MIRHPP is something we wanted to talk to you about. And we know it's had its critics, most notably Patrick Condon, who's been on our show recently. Can you speak maybe, first of all, to MIRP, but also about his critique of the program, what he gets wrong, and then maybe a little bit about your take on it?
Sure. I think one of the great things the city can do is partner with the development industry to get affordable housing and even get to restart the supply of purpose-built rental housing. Because for four decades, we haven't seen any in this city, just because the conditions under which rental gets built have not been conducive to any kind of investment. You know, and I think at the end of the day, you have to think, mayor and council, they have to think, let's pretend it's like their investment, it's their pension fund. And just to start with, I think, you know, cities don't build affordable housing. Cities set the conditions and rules under which the industry or the market can build housing that's affordable. And so in my view, partnering with industry is the way forward. The MERC program is a really good example of that, where we know that, for example, the amount of money that you can pay for a piece of land, if you're going to build rental housing, the value of that land is probably half of what you could afford to pay if you're going to sell it forward as condo. So the implication is, well, you need some vitamin D. You need some density and intensity over and above what you would normally get for a condo if you want to incent the development of rental housing. Purpose-built market rental housing. And so that's what the city's done with this moderate income program. And they've said they've added an extra bar to say if you satisfy 20% of the area at rents that are affordable to middle-income earners, so a studio. And here's what Patrick gets wrong. One of the things he gets wrong, he focuses on just the highest rent in the spectrum. He ignores the affordability of the other things. So a studio for $950 a month, your readers will say, hey, that's pretty good, downtown Vancouver. Or a one bedroom for $1,200 a month, a two bedroom for $1,600 a month, and a three bedroom for $2,000 a month. Put it this way, minimum wage is going to be $15.20 June of this year. So someone earning minimum wage, working full-time, can almost pretty much afford a studio apartment at $950 a month. I think it'll take maybe 36% of their income rather than 30, but it's close. And that's from a market program where the private sector is building it. They're taking all the risk. They're operating it for the life of the building or 60 years, whichever is greater. Those rents can only go up by the RTA increases every year. They're protected. This is a good deal for the city, and most people renting will appreciate those rents as being far below what market rents are, even for existing units. You're getting a new unit at these below market unit rents, and in return, the city grants the developer extra height and density, quid pro quo. And to me, that's fantastic. I think people who suggest that the city should go ahead and build all of our affordable housing are treading on very thin ice. As someone who's worked in that field, I used to work for 5 years for CMHC, looking after all of the co-op and nonprofit housing in British Columbia. My territory was half the province. They don't realize the cost. And so there's the upfront cost. It's like an iceberg. The bricks and sticks are the tip of the iceberg. To actually build the building is just the tip of the iceberg. What's below the surface are the ongoing operating subsidies for the life of the building. And if you hear someone saying that city should build all of our housing and subsidize it below market, you have to ask yourself who's paying that bill, because frankly, it's a huge bill. And I think it's naive to suggest that the city should go it alone like that. And I think it's naive to think that this is somehow going to economically work out right for everybody. I'm a parent, I've got two teenage kids. And all through my parenting life, I've had this sort of expression like, this isn't going to turn out well. And I think that's the case, where people say that, the city should build all of our housing. I think the city is better positioned to partner with senior levels of government. The model has been the city provides land and senior levels of government build it and subsidize it. That's been Vancouver's a fairly successful model, up until when the Fed stopped funding affordable housing and handed it over to the province. But the province has $6 billion to spend right now on affordable housing. And you'll see a number of new investment and reinvestment and redevelopment projects move forward for thousands of units of below market housing on that partnership model. But yeah, I think it's naive to think that the city is going to build all of our below market housing. It'll break the bank.
Right. It sounds like just to maybe going back a little bit, just so everyone understands the MERP program here, instead of the city actually building affordable housing, they've partnered with the development community and offered incentives to build purpose-built rental as opposed to condominiums, if I have that correct. And
right.
And the incentives are you can build higher density. And mm-hmm. Is there community amenity contributions there that you are...
The city will waive the development cost levy. So when I worked at the city back in 2002 to 2006, the development cost levy was $3 a square foot. Today, it's $28 a square foot.
Wow.
So it's gone up a lot.
Inflation.
And so, yeah. So what the city will do is waive the DCL. The DCLs pay for parks, for daycares. You know, it's a limited basket of goods. But generally, the city has the ability to waive those where there's affordable housing being provided because the housing is the amenity.
Right.
Both the market, the market rental housing, frankly, in a coming out of a four-decade period where no new market rental was being built, where our vacancy rates were plummeting below 1%, below 0.5%, even just getting market rental housing is in effect a public amenity because we're adding to the supply, we're taking the stress off that submarket of housing. And then on top of that, you're getting 20% of the units or 20% of the area at rents far below market. So in return, yes, you get some vitamin D, you get some density and height, and you get the DCLs waived. That's really the extent of the subsidy the city is granting. It's fairly modest. The DCL waiver is maybe 4% of the capital cost of the new rental units. It's a one-time thing, and for the rest of the life of that project, the private owner operator. And like when you build a rental building, you don't run away with all the profits. You know, you've got to finance the building and then you've got to operate it for
right.
the next 50, 60, 100 years. So it's a job. You've just created a job for yourself, you know, fixing toilets and taking care of property and, you know, generally being responsible for the building. So it's a good deal because the private sector takes all of the risk. The city is not on the hook for a penny for the rest of the life of that building. Now, where I think Patrick Conan gets it wrong is that he made a claim in the TIE that he could build four times with the same amount of subsidy he could build four times the number of units, but at much deeper levels of affordability, rents for $1,000 a month and units that are 1,000 square feet each, and he could build four times the number of those units and then generate an operating surplus that would in turn fund new rental housing. And you know, I think that this is where you get into the academics versus pracademics debate. And I think that people who have academic status and tenure that have high profile and immediate presence have a special responsibility to do their homework when it comes to critiquing policy, especially housing policy. And when I looked at Patrick's claims and I thought, no, he hasn't done the math. There's no competent economics to support what he's saying. And this is what happens when people think, oh, you know, they wave a magic wand at the problem. You need to do the math. You need to really marry the plans to the pro forma and then give political leadership and direction. And when I challenged Patrick on it, he couldn't produce a competent pro forma to back up what he's saying. I took it upon myself to try. And what I found was the alternate program that he suggested doesn't make sense. It's not viable. It actually loses money every year. It has a mortgage. He thought he could build it just based on the subsidy that the moderate income program was receiving, but that was not the case.
So it sounds like it's yeah, and we should say in part we're talking about this because there was a back and forth between you and Patrick in the TIE that was really interesting, right? He critiqued the MERP policy, and then you came back, and it's yeah. Anyone listening who wants to dig into the details. The TIE
yes.
is the place, and we'll link to that in our show notes for sure.
And I'll tell you that there's only one pro forma that exists on that file, and it's mine. So Patrick, he still has not produced a pro forma to support what he's saying. So I think frankly, someone in that position really needs to show their mouth. And if you can't, well, you know, I think. If you're going to give policy advice, if you want to lead the city, you know, I think Patrick ran for mayor at one point, had to pull out. But I think if you're going to be that leadership person, you need to have substance to back up your claims. And frankly, I'm still waiting for his pro forma. He doesn't want to get into the weeds, he says. But, okay.
Yeah. So with these, because there's a lot of purpose-built rental being built right now, or I shouldn't say a lot, but there's some. It seems like it's more part of the conversation than it was for sure. So this 20% below market where the rents are below market in perpetuity,
mm-hmm.
The program sounds like it's a win for you. Is the challenge actually just getting more built?
Absolutely. So I'll put it in perspective. I've also did a pro forma for Tony Papa Jones' Birch and Broadway program that also attracted a lot of criticism. People were charging that this was a giveaway, and that the developer was going to have runaway profits because of the extra height and density. What I showed, and my intuition, my development intuition, and my planning intuition told me that, no, this is marginal. And I think this is what your listeners need to understand. Like, these market rental programs are quite marginal. So the pension fund of the mayor, council, myself, as employees of, I was a former employee of the city, so I have a municipal pension. The benchmark return that the municipal pension plan of British Columbia seeks for domestic real estate is 6.7%. So you invest $100 million in a real estate project, the pension fund wants $6.7 million back every year on that $100 million. So the returns that I'm seeing on market rental projects, like the MRF projects, are barely over 4% per annum. That's before tax, before finance. So, it's not runaway money. It's not runaway profit. There's still quite marginal products. So people have the choice. They could build condominiums or you could build rental housing. You have to incent the development of rental housing. And I think we need to do that with clear heads, clear economics, and be flexible with plans.
One thing that strikes me is that I would ask it as a question, but it seems fairly obvious that I think in the narrative of the problems of the city around affordability, that the greedy developer kind of is the villain,
and that,
it's kind of a caricature, right? And I think that's a huge problem. But the more interesting question for me is, why are these developers actually building this this purpose-built rental with such low returns?
Well, I think if you already own the land, and if you are in the business of, a lot of developers are patient investors and are willing to take a lower return over a longer period. So CMHC did a really interesting study that I link in reference to in the articles in the TIE and in the debate on the Broadway and Birch program. If you just Google it, you'll find my post probably on Twitter or something. But CMHC did a really interesting study, and they found that there are conditions, in major urban centers where developers will accept a lower return over a longer period of time. So it really depends on the amount of density you can get on a site and to the cost of developing. Mm-hmm. So if you already own the land and you can get more use of that site, then the numbers generally work, especially in a low interest rate environment. I think that'll all change if interest rates go up. I think we'll see a lot less rental housing being built in Vancouver.
So, Michael, maybe just kind of pulling back and thinking about some other steps that the city can take to improve affordability. Can you talk about some of your thoughts on that? And then also, we'd like to hear kind of realistically where you actually see the next 5 to 10 years actually playing out on the ground.
As a pracademic.
Yeah, as a pracademic.
As a pracademic.
So maybe your hopes and dreams, yeah. But then also the reality of the situation.
Yeah, I don't think there's one solution. So, for example, the moderate income rental program, it can't be the one and only solution for affordable rental. Folks like Patrick will say, will criticize it because it's not meeting the needs of the lowest income earners. Well, it can't. One program can't cover all bases. So I think as a housing strategy moving forward, that's informed by economics and development interests. I think we need to look at multiple sub-markets of rental. So, core need housing, I think we need to partner with the federal and provincial governments more. They've got a lot of money to invest, and the city can be a great partner by providing, land or airspace in order to create very affordable housing for people who are living with low incomes. We should continue to incent market rental because the increasing supply will impact vacancy. It will impact asking rents. We're already seeing that as a few thousand new units come onto the market. There are impacts. People who criticize supply side theory, it's not going to, the landlords are price setters, not price takers. That doesn't pan out. You know, that's also the case in Seattle, you know, where more supply means lower rents and higher vacancy and more choice for people.
Right.
So we should continue programs like MERP. I think we need, you know, the last thing I did when I was working as a major project planner for the city was the policy plan for Oak Ridge Center, which kicked off, I think, probably a dozen, a half dozen other major regional mall retrofits throughout the region. So, you know, we're looking at major projects like that where we can make better use of land, add multifamily housing at pretty decent intensity. You can see more affordable forms of multifamily. And I think it's going to be a multifamily future. You know, very few people can afford a $2 million suburban house in the city of Vancouver, a $3 million form. It's not going to be mm-hmm. the solution. And then what I think what we can do is with city plan, we can look at broad brush changes for all neighborhoods to enable, you know, almost as of right types of gentle infill that get more than 2 units per lot, you know, 4 units per lot, maybe 6 units per lot. The type of development that we see in Kitts and Mount Pleasant and Strathcona, remember those, some of the most livable parts of our city, and replicate that in neighborhoods that have good transit, local shopping, and you know, great streets. So we can do that. I think we can do that in a very general way across the city. Yes, our neighborhoods are unique, but guess what? The DNA of Vancouver, I can tell you right now, is 33 feet, 40 feet, 50 feet by 120 foot with a 20-foot lane behind it. You know, our neighborhoods are different, but the DNA that underpins all of them is pretty identical, no matter where you go. That changes if you go outside of Vancouver, but generally speaking, I think we can come up with forms of infill that don't require, you know, a year or 2 years of rezoning, that will give us multifamily options that are intrinsically less expensive than, you know, the single family status quo. And the status quo, if we don't change, the status quo is what I see. I've been living in Dunbar for the last 5 years, is a $3 million house being torn down and replaced by a $5 million house. That's right. The status quo. So if we do nothing, it's just going to get worse. We have to do something. We need a retrofit. I go back to this classic because I can pick up my 1997 thesis. You know, the last thesis that Walter Hardwick signed in his career was mine, and it was, you know, the thesis was, hey, we have to retrofit our cities and suburbs to meet economic, environmental, social needs moving forward.
Maybe as it's actually a kind of perfect segue to maybe a final question for you here, Michael. You wrote about retrofitting the suburbs in 97. That's, let me see here, 25
years. 24
years
ago.
Yeah, 24 years ago. So this has been talked about for a while. We're still seeing $3 million houses torn down and $5 million houses replacing them. Are you optimistic about the next 5, 10, 15 years? Do you think Vancouver is going to get a significant facelift in terms of densifying areas outside of the core?
I see it happening. You know, I see it happening on the high streets. The city is, you know, coming up with this C2R program to incent rental on our shopping streets by allowing 2 more floors for if you do a rental building. 6 stories you can do in wood. That's inherently affordable. They're talking about transitional areas that build off of the high streets where we can. You know, they're looking at enabling low-rise apartments and you know, middle. We'll call it missing middle kind of housing. The voices in support of that are growing. And I think, you know, my friend Gordon Price, the mentor of friend, you know, former, I think the 6th-term city councilor of the city of Vancouver, Gordon's fantastic. He talks about the grand bargain, which was, you know, what we're going to limit change to our downtown, to the new neighborhoods, and maybe to that first ring of streetcar suburbs, but we're not going to touch the next ring out. And this applies in a lot of cities, like a lot of different cities in the region. Kind of politicians work off the same grand bargain, you know, like we're not going to touch these neighborhoods; they're sacrosanct. But I think just the sheer cost of housing in those places is slowly changing that, and you're hearing more people in support of changes. People who live in these neighborhoods who say, "I'd love to take my big old house and either adapt it, tear it down, rebuild it, infill it." So I could house myself, downsize into a bungalow, single level living, and accommodate my kids in 2 or 3 other units that are stratified. Those voices are going to get louder, and the city's looking at waiving minimum parking requirements, which is a huge win for affordability in multifamily, because frankly, you're achieving two things. One, you know, climate and environmental benefits in terms of incenting people to take transit or cycle. And the second is, you know, a parking stall underground, the hard cost is $50,000, maybe $120-$130 a square foot times an average of 400 square feet per stall. But then on top of that, you have soft costs, design costs, all the other expenses. Like a stall is actually about $60,000 to $70,000 at the end of the day for one. So if we waive minimum parking requirements, you know, we set the conditions for more affordable housing. So I think we'll see more change in more neighborhoods and people making better use of land. But we need to do it carefully. Back to that adage around, you know, increased intensity with commensurate amenity. So it's this balancing act. And we have to be careful, for example, with the amenity, not to gold plate it or platinum plate it. I think for decades, the city enjoyed extracting CACs from new development. So the next person to buy a new condo is paying for the daycare or the child, you know, or the cultural facility.
Right.
But we have to be careful because that, you know, a lot of people say that doesn't come out of the cost of land. Doesn't come out of the price of the housing. It comes out of the land price that the developer pays to the landowner. Well, that's not entirely true, because in order for that to happen, you need perfect information, and the whole CAC process is full of imperfect information. And I've heard the game described as community amenity cocaine. We've got CACs. We've got Vancouver has two drug problems. But we have to be careful about what we extract out of new development to make sure that we're not, in fact, taking it out of the pockets of people trying to buy a new house. But we can move forward. Yeah. There are other cities doing interesting things like this, you know. So we just seen Sacramento essentially outlaw single family zoning, which is kind of interesting, and been waiving parking requirements. Portland is doing similar things. So I think, you know, we can see in our cities, various places, built examples of what we could do in lower density parts of our cities and replicate them.
Fantastic. Well, we have a segment called the Five Wire, five kind of lighthearted or not so lighthearted. They seem to be getting increasingly more
sure.
less or less lighthearted. Can you stick around for that?
We'll keep it light.
Yeah. A couple heavy hearted in there. First question is, Michael, what is your favorite neighborhood in Vancouver?
Oh, tough one, because I've lived all over the place, you know, living here for 30 years. As a student, especially, you move around. So I'd have to say, you know what? Downtown Triangle West. I lived in Triangle West for about 4 years, and boy, talk about propinquity and being close to everything. And ironically, massive sociability within a high-rise building. I knew more of my neighbors in the high-rise than I've met in Dunbar. In Dunbar, I know my neighbor to my left, my neighbor to my right, nobody else. Downtown, I knew scores of people in my building. Biff Naked would kiss my daughter, you know, in her little pram going up the elevator. My next door neighbor was Matthew Good. I knew so many interesting people in that building. People criticize high rises for being antisocial. Bunk.
I found that too. I always find that strange that it's, you know, the cold and I feel like when I used to live downtown too, I knew everyone in the building.
Every building has a front door, a mail room, a lobby, we had a concierge. You know, it was a social oasis. Everyone gathered there. It's amazing. Okay, first question.
Favorite bar or restaurant?
Oh, man, Taco Fino. Well, I'd give right now for a cod taco and a dirty margarita.
But not at home.
Only
if it's at the restaurant. What is one book that you would recommend anyone listening should read?
Well, if we're talking about Vancouver and the future of Vancouver, I've just rearranged my books. I just moved recently, so I had to rearrange my bookshelf, and I had to decide what stayed on the top shelf. And it's Larry Beasley's Vancouverism, which just came out, which is a really fascinating read. I'm actually teaching for Larry this month in his SCARP class. So I'll pull it out and give myself a refresh. It's a great book.
We've actually given away, I think, 100 on this show.
Yeah,
I think we've given 100 copies away on this
Larry's
show.
Larry's actually been on the show a few times. Yeah. That's a great book, though.
It is a fantastic book. What is one piece of advice that you'd give your 18-year-old self?
Trust your intuition. Trust your intuition. It's always in my life. I've made some interesting choices and took different paths. And I always followed my gut. And I think I'd go back. I'd tell myself it's going to be okay.
Last question for you, Michael. One thing over the last year or two you have bought for under $1,000 that has transformed your life.
Or made a positive impact, or tweaked it slightly.
Oh my gosh! In this time of pandemic, I gotta say, the other day on Amazon, I bought a $150 massage table, and my partner, my wife Josie, is a personal trainer, and oh my gosh, it's the best thing ever! Like having living in a spa. It's amazing for $150.
So, you need the person to massage you.
I was gonna say,
you
need an in-house masseuse, though, correct?
That's right. No, it's quid pro quo. You got to trade these things. No, as long as you've got a great partner, it'll all work out.
Right.
Wow. Sounds like you have a really great partner.
I do.
Well, we'll leave it there. But Michael, how can people find out more about what you're doing, more about what you're writing, and of course, Livable City Planning?
Yeah. So my website's livablecityplanning.com. I'm pretty active on Twitter. I think it's M. Mortensen on Twitter. And I've got to do some more work on my marketing. But I work for a handful of clients. Very interesting, diverse projects. And so you'll see me pop up in the media from time to time. I love what I do. I love this city. I've been bitten by urbanism from the minute I arrived here. I cycled here from London, Ontario in 1990 over the Rockies. Yeah, and the minute I landed in Vancouver, I was just stunned by the beauty of the place. And this interesting juxtaposition of the city, mountains, the ocean. It's never dull, I tell you. It's a great place to work.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again, Michael, for your time. We'll have to have you back on to talk about that cycling story.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sleeping with the great bears. Yeah. All right.
Take care, and thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
So there you have, folks, our discussion with Michael Mortensen, director of Livable City Planning, but also he teaches at Sauder School of Business. He's an urban planner. He writes in the Taiyi, engaged in various debates, and just what a great conversation.
Yeah, I love that conversation. It was so great having Michael on the program. Next week, it would be a huge mistake not to mention our guest for next week, because join us next week for none other than Colin Boza, the CEO of Boza Properties. Colin was actually somebody that we've wanted to have on the program for 5 years now.
I would say since the start of 2016.
Yeah, exactly. And we finally got him, and that's thanks in a large part to Gene Openshaw.
VP of sales over at Boza.
VP of sales. I hope I've only ever read Gene's name because it's always somewhere in the Boza marketing and then in the emails and everything else. But
Gene right. It's Openshaw, I think you're concerned about.
Yeah. No, yeah. Could you imagine? I was
like, it's Jean.
Jean? Is it Jean? Anyways, Gene is amazing. She's been great to connect us to people at Boza. So thank you, Gene. And she's great to work with as well.
Absolutely. Boza, so. Absolutely.
What else we got? What else do we have today? Before we go, we have VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This is our website where all things real estate live.
Yes.
Things like the Livewire. This is our mailer every week in, week out. We sent the stats out this month before anyone else, I would say, and including stats that you can't get anywhere else, sub-markets, sub-regions. You want to be on the Livewire to get that. We also have Deal of the Month and an assortment of other real estate-related things. There's no reason why you shouldn't be on the Livewire.
Sure.
We also have private client services.
And Matt, if you are not using PCS, you are standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, days on market. You get realtor level information. It's free. It's at your fingertips. It's available through VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. And really, there's no better way to search for real estate in Vancouver. And I got to say, these guys are getting a facelift, and it hasn't been a long time coming. In fact, I've always loved how just basic the software is, because it's not fancy like other, like I feel like there's like a race to be complicated and fancy
or
in
to
how
be
you
like,
show like how you market listings. But these guys, it's simple. And that's what I love about it, is it's like there's a new listing, it shows you the photo, it integrates with maps, it gives you all the information, but it looks kind of beta.
And it's like a spreadsheet, right?
Yeah.
You can see, okay, this one sold, it sold for this price.
It's great for numbers people that just want the straight dope.
Yeah, it gives you the straight dope. Also, if you don't even care about numbers at all, it just gives you properties 36 to 72 hours before everybody else.
Right.
And gives you information you need.
Exactly. But they are getting a face. So it's going to be, I think, prettier, but hopefully the same functionality. We're actually doing some testing with them right now, and I was on a call the other day kind of looking over the new research tool. One thing about it, you can do a lot more with it.
Yeah.
So stay tuned for that. We're super excited. And then, of course, we have the Sellers Club, Matt.
That's right. The Sellers Club. This is the hottest club in Vancouver right now, and the safest, Adam.
We also have a big incentive right now, Matt. If you are thinking about listing in the spring market, or if you have a friend that you want to introduce us to who's thinking of buying or selling this spring, get in touch. We have a password, Matt. The password is PowerWalker2021.
That's right, PowerWalker2021.
Exactly. So if you introduce us to a friend, or if you want to list your property, we have an incentive for you. This is going to be running for a very short period of time, so do get in touch. And what else, Matt, before we cut for the day?
I would only say that if you want to talk about that or anything else,
right,
give me a call at any time, 778-847-2854 or matt@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or adam@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
We also have that secret line, info@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
Well, have a great week, guys. And next week, Colin Boza.
Does not disappoint. Enjoy.
2,000 Spaces for Radio. Subscribe today.
Hey everyone, pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible.
This podcast is sponsored by Common Ground Consulting.
Are you developing in the Lower Mainland? Common Ground Consulting is a development management and consulting company with experience in single family, townhouses, multifamily, and commercial developments.
What I love about Common Ground, Adam, is they manage the whole development process, from due diligence and feasibility reports for initial purchase of land to completing rezoning, development permits, and building permits.
They streamline the whole process with strong relationships with sub-consultants and municipalities and a deep understanding of all city requirements.
Common Ground Consulting. Feasibility and efficiency prioritized every step of the way.
Learn more at commonground-consulting.com or 604-807-6419.
We are also sponsored by Oakwin Realty. This is our real estate brokerage, best brokerage in the city, hands down. If you are in the industry, a new agent, an aspiring agent, somebody just looking to make a change, new culture, new energy, new resources, head over to oakwin.com/join, type in VRP 2020. That's oakwin.com/join, type in VRP 2020. Not only do you get to meet Michael Morgan and the gang, the bigwigs over at Oakwin, you get a huge incentive for first going to oakwin.com/join, typing in VRP 2020.